My name is Ryan Kingsley, and I'm the editor of Mortgage Banker magazine. I'm here today to read for you Manufacturing Fair Lending. But first, a quick word from our sponsor. Hang tight.
Designed for the busy mortgage professional, NMP's The Daily is the one newsletter you need to know everything that's happening in today's market, delivered to your inbox every weekday. Sign up for free today at nationalmortgageprofessional.com and see why we're the trusted source for originators.
Sometimes I'm blamed for some of this, says Paul Hancock, a civil rights attorney who spent more than 20 years in senior roles at the Department of Justice developing and implementing the U.S. government's fair lending enforcement programs. But I think that this has gone really pretty far away from where we started. As chief of the Housing and Civil Enforcement Section at the DOJ, under Attorney General William Barr, Hancock helped to bring forward the government's first redlining case in 1992, filed against Atlanta, Georgia-based Decatur Federal Savings and Loan Association. In private practice now as a partner at K&L Gates and consultant for Gatehouse Compliance, subsidiary of the mortgage advisory firm Gatehouse Strategies, he says there's no question lenders are opting not to litigate redlining lawsuits brought against them by the government, even if the government's legal theory and factual analysis of the cases is wrong. Redlining is a terrible accusation, Hancock says. It's a terrible thing to do. It means you're refusing to make loans in an area based on the racial composition of the neighborhood. Nobody supports that. We abhor it. Our clients abhor it. The question is, though, what's the standard for determining whether you're redlining or not? In October 2021, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland launched the DOJ's Combating Redlining Initiative, a renewed emphasis on tackling redlining, a discriminatory practice where lenders deny or avoid providing mortgages or other credit services to neighborhoods based on the race or national origin of the residents of those neighborhoods. Hancock began warning lenders after this launch that new kinds of redlining cases would stem from the new initiative. As a matter of course, he was right. In the past 3 years, regulators have initiated numerous redlining lawsuits and even more investigations against depository and non-depository mortgage lenders across the U.S., bringing cases forward under a modern theory of redlining that fair lending and legal experts call untenable. They call regulators' demands for a racial balance in originations unconstitutional. If the government is actually demanding a racial balance in loan originations, saying all lenders in the city of Chicago should make 20% of their loans in minority neighborhoods, Hancock posits, that's a demand for a racial balance that is prohibited by the Constitution. It's prohibited by civil rights laws. I think that, if tested, it would be rejected by the courts in this context. Steve Simpson, director of separation of powers litigation for the Pacific Legal Foundation, a public interest legal organization that advocates for limited government, recently defended Chicago-based Townstone Financial against a CFPB lawsuit accusing the non-bank lender of redlining. A district court dismissed the case, a decision which the CFPB appealed. Simpson says lending disparities, which regulators call redlining, differ greatly from the literal practice from which the term originated. Any disparity in a bank's lending to one group or another is just held to be de facto redlining, he says. I just think that's flawed. Noting his position in the intellectual minority, he adds that very few people care to address the flawed premise driving the government's approach to identifying redlining. He also predicts there is more fair lending litigation to come, given the Supreme Court's decision last June to overturn race-based affirmative action in college admissions. The more it seems clear that the Supreme Court is against race-conscious policies, he continues, the more in favor of those policies regulators become. The term redlining derives from the literal practice employed by the federal government and lenders of drawing red lines around neighborhoods they would not invest in based on those neighborhoods' racial composition. The practice was enshrined in the Federal Housing Administration's 1938 underwriting manual, which prohibited the occupancy of properties except by the race for which they are intended, among other racist housing policies. Redlining lawsuits against non-depository mortgage lenders are a recent phenomenon. Traditionally, only depository banks were audited by federal regulators for compliance with the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act, which outlawed redlining and established a framework for regulators to assess depositories' progress at meeting the credit needs of their entire communities, including low to moderate income and majority-minority neighborhoods. The primary argument against CRA mandates for non-depository lenders is that those institutions do not receive deposits with which they can reinvest in communities. However, non-depositories have always been subject to other non-discrimination and fair lending laws. Natural disparities will always exist in lending, Simpson says. Inferring redlining or intentional discrimination from statistics compounds the problem by propagating the fantasy of an achievable equilibrium. Accusing lenders who originate a below-average number of mortgages in CRA-eligible census tracts of redlining without demonstrating a lender's intent to avoid or otherwise restrict access to mortgage credit in those communities manufactures perceptions of discriminatory lending, while pushing lenders to manufacture their fair lending compliance. Lenders' inability or unwillingness to litigate against the government, given the expense, inflates perceptions of rampant redlining and the effectiveness of regulators' combating efforts. While the CRA speaks to income, not race, Hancock says, in most of these areas, there's a great overlap between racial concentrations and low and moderate income concentrations. So, the government could analyze a bank's loan distributions and see if they're intentionally avoiding doing business in the minority communities of your assessment area. That was the theory. By relying on lending disparities to establish patterns of discrimination, regulators' enforcement of that theory corrupts the original intent of the CRA statute, claiming that lower levels of originations in CRA-eligible census tracts equates to redlining, makes fair lending enforcement and lenders' compliance a data exercise. Under the government's theory, you can eliminate redlining by just making fewer loans in white areas. You're not doing any more in minority areas, Hancock says. You're making fewer loans in white areas, and somehow that solves your legal problem. That just doesn't make any sense. The reputational harm of being accused of redlining lives with lenders, not regulators, Simpson says, compounding the ill effects of ill-designed efforts to regulate away historical disparities. Simpson calls regulating away disparities in lending political, but not in the sense of Democrats versus Republicans. Regulators and everybody out there today in various sectors of the economy, and finance being one, he says, are just falling all over themselves to look like they're combating inequality. The Illinois Community Reinvestment Act, which took effect in January 2024, uses proportional loan distributions to assess depository and non-depository mortgage lenders for fair lending compliance, mirroring a 2007 Massachusetts law for supervising non-banks. They care about how they're being perceived or feeling like they're combating a great social ill, Simpson believes. When they actually try to implement these policies, they make no sense. And the real experts, like the Mortgage Bankers Association, who knows what it's doing and understands all this stuff much better than, in my view, the Illinois regulators, no one is paying attention to them. No matter whether government overreach is occurring, says Brian Montgomery, co-founder of Gatehouse Strategies and former deputy secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Biden administration's focus on redlining, however defined, makes the issue top of mind for mortgage lenders. Drawing parallels to the heightened focus on cybersecurity given a recent spate of high-profile breaches, even if there's a change in administration, Montgomery affirms, there will continue to be a focus on this topic, as there should be. But a regulatory rat race mostly hurts consumers on account of the added complexities and expenses for businesses' compliance. Some states have the benefit of staying reliably red or blue, but whipsawing regulations means businesses must remain ready to pivot at all times, depending on the regulatory priorities of the day. The headaches and expenses that arise can be exorbitant. The lenders here are facing an issue, Hancock adds. If there is a change of administrations, will they suddenly be tagged for doing what was demanded of them now? Lenders must hedge their fair lending compliance to satisfy regulators' present demands for a racial balance, while avoiding future legal liability for doing just that. Under a second Trump administration, the DOJ, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and the CFPB would likely look very different. There could be completely different theories espoused as to not only what the law requires, but what the law permits, Hancock worries. Therein lies the untenable nature of the government's strategy for combating redlining. The problem arises when they start inferring discrimination from statistics when they don't have direct evidence of discrimination, says Simpson, referencing his work with Townstone Financial. You end up trying to compel mortgage companies or businesses to lend on the basis of race and on the basis of other factors that they're not supposed to take into consideration, which just creates an equal protection problem through perverse incentives and perverse effects. The perverse application of the law of unintended consequences means that any community or anybody who operates on a community level can ultimately be accused of discrimination, he continues. In some sense, precisely because they're operating locally and helping a given population, or they're operating by word of mouth and just talking to their circles, their friend circles, their community circles, i.e. referrals, which is how most of mortgage lending works. Such disparate impact discrimination is at the heart of regulators' modern theory of redlining. Richard Andriano, partner and practice leader of the mortgage banking group at Ballard Spahr, a national law firm, says he probably would not have appealed the Townstone Financial case up to the Seventh Circuit. Andriano also leads Ballard Spahr's fair lending team. In 2015, the Supreme Court ruled in Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs v. the Inclusive Communities Project, Inc., that plaintiffs must meet a rigorous standard to establish a clear-cut case of disparate impact discrimination under the Fair Housing Act. The justices even noted that claims based on statistical disparities fail without showing robust causation. On remand, the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas applied that new standard and found the plaintiff, Inclusive Communities, fell short of showing robust causation. The outcome of these proceedings confirmed that disparate impact discrimination claims were legitimate under the Fair Housing Act, but that plaintiffs proceeding under a disparate impact theory face a significant burden of proof. It was clear the court was very concerned about the rules in that area, says Andriano. And if you went too far, were you actually in effect mandating the consideration of race in a way that would appear to be contrary to the Constitution? However, in 2013, HUD implemented its own discriminatory effects rule to formalize disparate impact liability. At the time, HUD noted the new rule had broad remedial intent and was imperative to the success of civil rights law enforcement. Two insurance industry trade groups sued HUD over the rule, arguing the rule exceeded HUD's authority under the FHA. Noting the Supreme Court would soon be taking up the issue in Inclusive Communities, a D.C. Circuit Court provisionally agreed with the insurance industry's challenge. The Supreme Court acknowledged HUD's 2013 rule in the Inclusive Communities decision, but did not defer to it. The D.C. court had to reconsider its ruling on the 2013 rule following Inclusive Communities. Before that could happen, a new HUD rule, the 2020 Fair Housing Act rule, was implemented during the Trump administration, supplanting the 2013 rule. Fair housing groups challenged the 2020 rule and won a preliminary injunction. The Biden administration then reinstated the 2013 rule in March 2023. Without revising for Inclusive Communities. Andriano calls this HUD's calculated error. They reinstated the 2013 rule almost verbatim. In September 2023, a decade after the case began, the D.C. court determined that in light of Inclusive Communities, HUD's 2013 rule does not conflict with the FHA when applied to insurers' underwriting and rating practices. However, the D.C. court noted that the 2013 rule may exceed limits laid out in Inclusive Communities. By adopting a rule that was adopted 2 years before that Inclusive Communities decision, says Andriano, and then claim that the rule is completely consistent with that future decision, was an error. I think you're going to see the Supreme Court rein that conduct in, saying, no, you have to actually follow our decisions. That calculated error could be amplified if the Supreme Court reverses or narrows the Chevron principle, a longstanding judicial precedent that says courts should defer to federal agencies' expertise when interpreting and administering federal statutes and regulations. After hearing oral arguments in a separate case in mid-January, the Supreme Court seems poised to overturn the Chevron principle. The CFPB appealed its case against Townstone Financial, arguing Chevron deference. All the redlining claims were brought against banks who had their banking regulator twisting their arm to settle. They settled. They sued the first non-bank, and the non-bank didn't want to settle. And that's how we're finally getting court review of this, Andriano says. It just never faced a challenge was the issue. I do think the courts, particularly if Chevron's thrown out, only if you just modify it, I think that could significantly change how courts defer. The same way underwriting standards are set by the government-sponsored enterprises, so are default servicing standards. Where fair lending focuses more on the origination side of mortgage lending, fair servicing kicks in after the loan closes, entailing such actions as collection processes, fee assessments, and a waterfall of loss mitigation options. The problem for many lenders, says Michael Waldron, founding partner of Gatehouse Compliance and former chief compliance officer at Community Loan Servicing LLC, formerly Bayview Loan Servicing LLC, is that fair lending and fair servicing at many mortgage companies remain disparate processes. It doesn't mean that it's not a priority, he explains. It doesn't mean that it's not resource intensive. It's just not as mature of a structure and mature from a thought leadership perspective. Hence, for mortgage lenders, fair servicing compliance can be more difficult to stay ahead of than fair lending compliance. The playbook has been out there, says Lisa Warner, a partner with CrossCheck Compliance. But interpreting the playbook and operationalizing it and incorporating it into a mortgage operation's day-to-day activities is not always clear. CrossCheck aided Townstone Financial with their data analysis in the process of their defense against the CFPB. These days, data reigns when it comes to staying out of regulators' crosshairs, Warner says. Regulators can assess servicing data for fair servicing compliance, looking for patterns that could signal discrimination, such as whether protected class borrowers are being foreclosed on more often than non-protected class borrowers. Fair servicing, Warner continues, obviously is not as mature of a process of monitoring as it is on the origination side, and you don't have a set of data like you have the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data to compare results to. It's a little more challenging that way. You really have to understand what's happening within the operation in order to conclude anything with respect to the data. Problematically, much of the data available to lenders for analysis offers a rear-view perspective. They know where their own loans are written, but the government is looking at a comparison with other lenders, and you don't have the other lenders' data until the following year, says Hancock. When it comes to peer benchmarking, there's no way of knowing. Use what you have, though, Warner says. You need to make sure as a company that the data is accurate, first of all, and that as an organization, you understand what the data is telling you. Am I in trouble or am I not? If so, what areas do we need to focus on? Somebody internally needs to really take that in and understand what it means and how to make changes. Lenders' failure to mine their own data for insights into potential fair servicing risks underscores the shortcomings of data reliance for fair lending and fair servicing compliance overall. What you don't want to do, Waldron explains, is take action that inadvertently doesn't mitigate the very issue that you're trying to solve for. Drawing bad conclusions from good data can lead lenders to make misguided investments or operational changes, inadvertently increasing long-term risks. As complex as we've set it out on the origination side, I would contend on the servicing side, it's a multiple in terms of complexity, Waldron says. The interaction is condensed on the servicing side. It's a continuum. It's a relationship. And it can touch everything from how you waive fees or give deference to your servicing client, your outreach efforts. How hard are you trying to reach them when an event occurs in the loss mitigation scenario? The difficulty of finding a comparable situation for an assessment's sake makes fair servicing compliance that much more difficult for lenders and regulators to assess, too. Every borrower's situation is unique, especially when they go into default. In a similar way that regulators can assess lending data to identify redlining, regulators can assess servicing data and draw conclusions about servicing discrimination. Ultimately, lenders have to get to their data before regulators do. When regulators are the first to identify patterns of potential discrimination in a lender's servicing data, that lender has already failed to demonstrate an awareness of their own potential shortcomings. The government would like to find a case of discrimination in servicing, says Hancock, and there hasn't yet been a major case. There might be one-off cases someplace, but there hasn't been a case of discrimination in servicing like there has been in discrimination and origination of loans or marketing, such as redlining. Thanks for listening to Manufacturing Fair Lending, which was released in the June 2024 edition of Mortgage Banker magazine. Get more like this at nationalmortgageprofessional.com and continue listening wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ryan Kingsley. Until next time.